I've not actually been shaken by a new band in, it must be a good 10 years now, and the last group that did it to me was Tinner Owen from the Sahara, from Mali, the Tuaregs. Well, there has been new music coming through which has shaken me since the 1980s, quite a lot of it. But the last thing that had that effect on me was, I'm afraid, now quite some time ago. It's been a lot before then, but things just seem to have gone very quiet again.
Why do you think that is?
It happens like that. It seems to go in cycles, periods of creativity and imagination, and then followed by rather barren, fallow periods. And it depends what kind of music you're talking about as well. I mean, one of the reasons that I started to look and listen elsewhere in the mid-1980s was, having been right on the front lines of rock and roll since the late 1970s, during a particularly creative and imaginative period, I found myself suddenly a Radio 1 DJ in 1985 and looked around and thought, wait a minute, you know, this isn't half as exciting as it was 7-8 years ago. But then I started to hear things that did excite me. They just didn't happen to come from Britain or the United States. They came from other parts of the world, you know, chiefly, for me, the African continent and the Caribbean.
So did somebody turn you on to that kind of music, or did you have to
Yeah, they did, the musicians. I just needed, like everybody else, the opportunity to hear music from those parts of the world. And as soon as I did, I mean, the first thing that really shook me was South African Township Jive. Then, you know, I started to hear music from other parts of Africa as well, and simultaneously in the Caribbean. So if anybody converted me to it, it was the people who were making that music. And I've always been my feeling, you know, if I've had any kind of mission on music radio, it's been the idea that I wasn't unique. And it proved to be true as well, that all most people needed was the opportunity to hear that kind of music, have it put in front of them, played to them, which was what I was doing on the radio for so many years, for them to like it. And it was really, it's not difficult, and it was just having the opportunity to hear it. And, I mean, look what happened. We're now at a festival that would have been unthinkable 25, 27 years ago. But now, and if I feel I've helped achieve anything, it's that it's not unusual now for a band from Burkina Faso to come and play in possibly even in Whitby, yeah. But anywhere in Britain.
You say that, like, you know, that music resonated with you and, you know, it really rung a chord with you. Can you remember right early on a record when you were growing up that you heard it and you knew that was music was going to be your life after that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're going back to when I thought it would become my life, I suppose. I knew it was going to be a lifelong obsession, probably from about the age of 12. But when I got to Leeds University and I became the entertainment secretary, the volunteer student who booked all the bands and ran all the concerts, it was at that point where I thought, this is actually going to be how I make my living, in some capacity or another. I mean, back then, I probably had secret ambitions to become the next Harvey Goldsmith. Promoting was what I thought I was going to go into, staging big concerts, and carry on being a concert promoter, which is what I was at university. But things got slightly blown off the tracks, or slightly derailed, or somebody switched the point, and instead of going into concert promotion, I ended up working with Billy Bragg's manager. And the pretty girl by style, and the simple girl by... ended up being his roadie driver, tour manager. And from that, I accidentally fell into broadcasting. So I would probably, if I'd not fallen into the broadcasting, I'd probably have ended up being in rock and roll management.
In the book on that, because I've read it a few times, it's the book that I read when I was at university, which took me into going into radio. I was going to ask you about when you were booking bands for Leeds University. You know, you're putting all these great bands on now. Did you realise what you were doing at the time?
It's very strange that you ask that question, because rarely are you involved in something where you have a sense that what you're doing is actually historic. It's usually only years later, with hindsight and the perspective, that distance, many years later, that you realise the significance of what you were doing. Strangely enough, with those concerts at Leeds in the late 70s, early 80s, I did actually sense that. Because the live music industry... Buster, shush. The live music industry then was very different. And it's, I mean, it seems implausible now, but the biggest bands in the world, when they were on tour in the UK, one of the venues that they would do routinely would be Leeds University. I mean, when the Rolling Stones did, in 1971, for example, on what was to be their farewell tour, before they became tax exiles and went to live in a chateau in the south of France and record Exile on Main Street, they played 8 dates in the UK before they left. One of those was at Leeds University. The biggest bands in the world played... It was a major, major venue. And to have been 19, 20, 21 and putting on those gigs, not the Stones one, I came along a bit later, I was aware of that because it was quite routine that on a Friday night I'd be standing there with my hand on a panel of light switches next to the stage, ready to switch off the house lights for Iggy Pop. Yeah, yeah. And the week after, it might be Elvis Costello and the Attractions. The week after that, it might be Black Uhuru. And, you know, the night after that, it might be The Clash or The Ramones. There were bands of that calibre week in, week out. And I did certainly think... I thought I was never going to have as much fun in my life again. The day I left, I thought, well, that's it. Life will never be so much fun again. So I was aware of the significance at the time.
I bet you never thought when you left your exam that to go and watch Bob Dylan that you'd end up interviewing him, doing a doc on him, though, did you?
Ramona, come closer, shout softly, oh, what area.
No, I never expected to meet him. And I also thought on the way home that I've probably blown my chances of getting into university by running out of me economics A-level to go and see him. And he was bloody awful. I was crushed.
You've interviewed some of your heroes, like a lot of them, like Bob Dylan, you know, Neil Young.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that meeting your heroes, was that a daunting experience for you? Were you excited you'd be able to ask questions that, you know, the ordinary music fanatic would want to find
nothing,
out?
Nothing daunts me. No, I'm not daunted by it. I'm not in awe of rocks. I'm in awe of people who... I may be in awe, but I'm not overwhelmed. I can always, you know, ask the right questions. I'm not intimidated, is what I'm trying to say. And just because somebody's famous, that in itself doesn't impress me. I'm in awe of those people who are maybe hugely famous and vastly talented, yet when you come face to face with them, they have humility and they're down to earth and they're civilised and they're courteous. I mean, I'm thinking of people like Willie Nelson and Dolly Parton. You know, Dolly Parton is one of the most famous women in the world, and I named my daughter after her because I'm such a big admirer. And one day, Dolly met Dolly. My Dolly was only 3 years of age, in Dolly Parton's dressing room at the Hammersmith Odeon. Dolly Parton was just about 5 minutes, 10 minutes away from walking on stage in front of a packed Hammersmith Odeon, and she had all the time in the world for this little girl who'd come in waving a wax crayon drawing she'd done of Dolly Parton at school that day. And the first thing Dolly Parton said to my Dolly when she was introduced was, Dolly Parton was in jewels, and she was in this white jewel dress. She looks absolutely stunning. And the first thing she said to my Dolly was, "Oh, Dolly, that's such a pretty dress you're wearing." And Willie Nelson, when Willie came and played with his whole band through the entirety of my radio show in '98, he walked in, and I swear to God, there was a saintly blue glow around him when he walked through the door. And he stood in front of me with the whole band and that battered little guitar. And when the red light came on, meaning we were recording, he looked at me and he said, "Well, Andy, what would you like me to play?" And I thought, oh, my God. One of the greatest songwriters of the 20th century, and he's asking me what I want to hear. I was almost stuck for words. Not something that happens to me very often.
Maybe I didn't love you. Quite as often as I could have.
Can you pinpoint then a moment in your career that so far that, like they said, the Willie Nelson thing there, that you've actually thought, bloody hell, I can't believe I'm sat here doing this with like these heroes of mine?
That's one. That was probably the most satisfying. If I'd had to pick one broadcast that was my favourite, yeah, it would be the afternoon that